This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In 2.5 weeks, Vermont voters will go to the polls to elect a new governor. And according to the new VPR poll, the race is a dead heat between Republican Phil Scott and Democrat Sue Minter. One of the issues in this race is tax policy. Scott has vowed to veto any bill that increases any tax or any fee.
I don't think we should have to raise any more taxes and fees. We should live within our means. We need to catch our breath here. We need to give Vermonters a break. And they're not getting that. They're feeling the struggles of everyday life. Everything's going up in their world.
How does this approach compare with the tax policies of Sue Minter? It's one of the questions we have for our guest today, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Sue, it's great to have you back on the program.
Great to be here, Bob. Thanks.
And you can always join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What are some of the most important issues that you want the next governor to focus on? Are you an undecided voter? If you are, we would love to hear from you today. We'd like to know what factors will influence how you'll make a decision in this race. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. But better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So let's start off with this idea of tax policy. Phil Scott has made a blanket statement, quote, "I will not support any increases in taxes or fees." Can you make the same statement?
Let me tell you this. I just want to start out by saying how excited I am to be now just over 2 weeks from Election Day. And I had a wonderful morning with the vice president, having breakfast with a great leader, a person who I admire so much for his fight for the middle class. And this weekend, I'm excited to be out on the trail, stumping with Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, Congressman Welch, really talking to Vermonters about what is important in this race. So I am really revved up. It is closing in. And there really are some real differences. So let's talk about it. I have been running, as you know, the second largest agency of state government and managing a $600 million budget for 6 years. And I will tell you that it is the last thing that we look for are new taxes. We looked instead to efficiencies. We looked to seeing what programs we could delay or ways we could, in fact, reduce costs. I want to give the example of our bridge program. It's called the Accelerated Bridge Program. We looked to efficiency and innovation. We went, Bob, and I think we've talked when we had 20% of our bridges in Vermont structurally deficient. Bridges were closing in an emergency all over the state. I'm sure we remember the Lake Champlain Bridge. And we worked hard across the aisle to create a transportation infrastructure bond fund to invest in our bridges, because if we didn't, and if they fell down, that would affect not just individuals and businesses, but our entire economy. So I think for me, that's an example of, yes, we need to invest, and we need to innovate, and we need to become more efficient. As a leader in the agency, we've pushed innovation and efficiency, and the Accelerated Bridge Program now has helped us move from a time when it used to take, on average, 8 years to build a bridge to now just, on average, 2 years. So we're building bridges faster, cheaper, and smarter, getting better tax value on the money that we're getting. And we've gone from 20% structurally deficient to just 7% structurally deficient. So as the governor, I'm going to focus on efficiency. I'm going to focus on innovation. I'm going to be accountable to taxpayers. I'm going to explain what it is we want to do with their money. And I'm going to make sure we invest to support our economy going forward.
So in terms of making a pledge not to raise taxes or fees during your first term in office, what would the answer be?
I'm not making a pledge, especially not knowing what's coming. Imagine if we had such a pledge in Irene. We've had to, after Irene, there were so many crises. And let's just talk about, it isn't just natural disaster that concerns me, although it does. It's what's happening around this state. And we can talk about our opiate epidemic. Did anyone predict 2 years ago that Bennington, the hospital in Bennington, would have to create a new wing for opiate-exposed newborns? We don't just turn our eyes to what's happening. We address them. We look to our communities to understand what we're dealing with. A leader has to explain, if they have to in any way increase investments, why and what they're doing it for, and making sure we follow the outcomes. I think what's happening is that people are angry because they don't know what government is doing with their money. That's why, as Secretary of Transportation, we really looked at outcomes. We know that we went from 20% structurally deficient bridges, the worst in the country, second worst, to now just 7%, near the top in the country. That means safe bridges. That means the economy isn't going to be interrupted. That's what I think Vermonters want to know, what we're doing with their money.
So you mentioned you'll be campaigning this weekend with a number of Democratic leaders, including Senator Bernie Sanders, who endorsed you, it seems like, a week or 10 days ago, if I remember correctly. At the time, you said you were very pleased to have that support because you both share supporting a living wage in Vermont and across the country. You also feel the same way about free college tuition. That was very important to you. Do you also share his belief that wealthy people need to pay more in taxes in order to have a fair tax system?
I had such a great conversation with Bernie. We spent an hour together really digging in on issues. And, of course, I shared with him how incredibly proud I am of what he has done in this election to change the course of the conversation around the country. And certainly, you know, I've spent the last year, Bob, traveling every corner of this state, talking with Vermonters from all different sectors, from Bennington to Newport. And it doesn't matter if you're a business owner, you're a elected official, a hospital administrator, nurses, teachers, social workers, healthcare providers, childcare providers. I have been reaching out to understand what's going on. And I think the biggest thing that's going on is that too many Vermonters, and it's true across the country, are struggling in this economy, working two jobs. Wages are not keeping up with the cost of living. And that's why I support so much my goal, my mission number one, to create more jobs, livable wage jobs, and economic opportunity, just like Bernie Sanders has been talking about. That's why we talked a lot about my program, Vermont College, 2 years tuition-free community or technical college. We talked about the fact that many Vermonters, young Vermonters, are leaving, and we want to make sure we create an economy and communities, livable communities, for young Vermonters to be able to live, work, and stay here. And we talked about how important it is for kids to get beyond college because, you know, in Vermont, we actually have the highest high school graduation rates in the country, but we also have nearly the lowest beyond high school. And Bernie has actually been championing this issue across the country. He's excited that we're going to be able to do it here in Vermont.
What about the idea? Do you share his belief that the wealthy in this country and in the state of Vermont are not paying their fair share in taxes, and that one way to raise new revenue is to raise taxes on wealthy people? Do you share that belief?
What I know is exactly what Bernie has been saying, is that income inequality is extreme around this country, and that we have those social and economic inequities here in Vermont. And it is exactly why I have developed the economic development plans that I have to reduce that inequality. And frankly, it is why I feel it is so important to get economic opportunity for the next generation. Because, look, right now, two-thirds of the jobs of the 21st century require some kind of education and training beyond high school. But in Vermont, 4 out of 10 kids are ending their education after high school. And this is an enormous opportunity gap. I believe it is really the nexus, the gap we need to close if we're ever going to close the economic inequality that Bernie talks about. And yes, my tax policy is focused on tax fairness. You know, I do think there is a very serious contrast between myself and my opponent when it comes to economic development. His plan looks to reduce taxes, for wealthy individuals, for corporations. And I think that leaves the middle class behind. I am actually looking at holding rates on sales tax, holding the rates on income tax, but instead looking at where are the loopholes? You know, why do we have exemptions for lobbyists, for folks that for limousine rides, for jet owners? Why should I want to look at the second home interest mortgage interest deductions? Those are the policies that I am looking at to reduce pressure on the middle class, to increase affordability in for things like college and childcare. Those are the challenges that middle class Vermonters around this state are facing, just like Bernie is talking about across this country.
Earlier this week at a debate, you criticized Phil Scott for voting to increase the sales tax by 20%. Your assertion seemed to suggest that you would not have supported that legislation. If I know the vote correctly, it was taken in 2003. It increased the sales tax from 5% to 6% to raise more money for state aid to education. It passed the House and the Senate with very strong Democratic support. So are you telling us today that if you'd been in the legislature at that time, you would have been one of the few Democrats to vote against that bill? That was Act 68?
What I'm telling you is that the sales tax is the most regressive tax. And the state did increase the sales tax from 5% to 6%. That's a $700 million burden on middle-class Vermonters. I'm not dealing in hypotheticals. I am going to, however, when people are accusing me of saying that I am planning to raise every tax under the sun, I'm going to point out and set the record straight and point out that, in fact, my opponent has also raised taxes.
But would you have voted the same way?
I was not there, as you know, Bob, so I am not going to make a speculation about that.
I'm just wondering if it's difficult to criticize somebody for something that you agree with the policy on.
Well, I think it's really interesting that I am being criticized for raising taxes, for claiming that I plan to raise taxes on every tax under the sun. I discussed at an interview looking at the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission as something that we should talk about. How do we think holistically about our tax code and the fact that it used to be based around an economy based on durable goods, and now 2/3 of our economy is our services? And because I said that one thing, I have been subjected to an onslaught of erroneous claims that I am going to raise taxes. Oddly enough, and let's just talk about what's happening in this election, we now know that the Republican Governors Association, whose largest contributor are the Koch brothers, the oil billionaire Koch brothers, have already spent over $2 million. Every time I talk at another forum, I hear about a flyer that they've received in the mail talking about a tax that I say I'm planning to raise, which is fallacious. And, you know, the oddest part is one of the first ads that went on was all about these taxes, and I think you see me as a bobblehead. And I want to point out, A, that I'm not a bobblehead, and I'm not a puppet of anyone else. I'm an independent thinker. And I have not said that I'm raising all these taxes, although people have over $2 million worth of advertising in their mailboxes and on TV saying that I am. And I will continue to set the record straight. Oddly enough, that first TV ad talking about all kinds of transportation-related taxes and fees, funny that Phil Scott, in fact, voted for the very same taxes. So let's just be real. Let's talk about what's a fact. Let's not be influenced by outside forces, the Koch brothers, who aren't interested, frankly, in a candidate for governor who's going to champion addressing climate change, but in fact are misleading people with over $2 million of investments to defeat me.
Today on the program, our guest is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Daniel in Essex Junction. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here. I heard Sue speak at the Renewable Energy Vermont conference last week. That's an industry trade association. And in addition to Sue, there was also outgoing Governor Peter Shumlin, Patrick Leahy, Peter Welch. No Republicans chose to show up to speak, apparently. Both Sue and Phil Scott are very much in favor of the 90% renewables by 2050 goal that's set by this legislature. However, when it comes to the actual pieces of putting that puzzle together, there are only two that I've seen Phil Scott has any standing on, and both of them he's chosen the wrong side. He's looking for a moratorium on industrial wind, and he pledged to veto any attempt to make a carbon pollution tax. Now, when you say that you're in favor of something, but everything else you do says the opposite, there's a word for it, and that's called lip service. Sue, I'm going to encourage you to hold Phil's feet to the fire regarding the divergence between what he claims to be in favor of and what he actually would do if elected, or attempt to do if elected governor.
Okay, Daniel, we appreciate your phone call. You know, we've gotten a lot of emails about the whole issue of wind. As you know, it's dividing many communities. In our new VPR poll, 12% of people responding thought that the Vermont Public Service Board should have the final say on these projects, and the rest favored a more localized decision-making process. I know when you were on the program previously, you said you supported the law passed by the legislature this year that gives towns, if they follow a certain planning process, to have what's known as substantial deference when the board reviews these projects. And under the law, the board can still approve a project despite strong local opposition. What do you say to those folks who feel that this wind issue is so divisive, it's tearing communities apart, and that wind energy is not baseload power and will have a minimal impact on Vermont's renewable energy future? What do you say to those folks?
Well, I want to thank Daniel for his question or his point, and to really underscore, number one, why the conversation around renewable energy and the aggressive goal of moving toward 90% renewable by 2050 is so important. And it's because climate change is not just real. It is here. We can think about what it's been like this last week with 80-degree weather in October. But more importantly, remember what happened last winter. We didn't have winter. Many of our ski areas were in the red. Many of them had to actually close. And what that did to an entire economy of the region that depends on those visits and those ski visits. But also looking all over the state, including the Northeast Kingdom, where we have snow machine trails and the general stores didn't have the traffic. This is an economic issue. And it is very important, not just for the future. It's not just something out there. It is here and it is real and is now. And we have to think about our maple industry. We have to think about our future. And that's why I am wanting to continue to keep a pedal on the metal. And, you know, Daniel was at a Renewable Energy Vermont conference. And to be there in an enormous room, I remember being a participant maybe 8 years ago at REV, Renewable Energy Vermont, and it was a much smaller group. But to think not only about climate and transforming our energy future, but what that is doing for our economy. There were hundreds of new businesses. When I am traveling this state, meeting businesses that are locating here, I met a small turbine wind developer, totally different from industrial wind, Ridgeline. It is actually looking to farmlands and looking to fewer numbers and smaller wind turbines. This new business owner bringing 200 new jobs to Vermont specifically because we have the best opportunity for growth. I don't want to put anything down about laying down some kind of red line saying, we don't want your business. We need your business. So to your point about the siting bill and this challenge that is ripping our communities apart, I am deeply concerned about the tenor of the discussion. And I'm going to step back to talk about what means so much to me as I have a degree in planning. And I think what is absent in our discussion is that we have big developers, many of them now out-of-state developers, some without an understanding and sensitivity to our culture of engagement and citizen participation in Vermont that is so important. And we have communities that don't have a voice. And that is what's creating the discord. That's why I am a proponent not just of the siting bill, but of actually looking at how our public service board process can actually be improved to engage more Vermont community voices. So we know now that we are engaging our regional planning commissions, our local planners, to say, okay, we have a statewide goal. How are we going to meet it? But how and where can we site facilities that don't result in this kind of divisiveness? I know people have been told that I'm planning to put industrial wind on every single mountaintop, and no, again, that is not my goal. My goal is to continue to work with the developers of these important technologies and look and listen and work with communities about what's important to them and where they will site facilities, where they will be part of the solution. That's the focus. We have got to have a broader view and a longer view. I believe we need a map, a state map of all of the resources, whether it's wind, biomass, whether we can talk about decarbonizing the natural gas and renewable sources of natural gas. We have to be thinking about all of it. And I'm just going to end by saying, please go to my website, look at my climate and energy plan, because I'm not just talking about renewable energy. I'm talking about how we reduce peak demand. That's going to help keep our electric energy both cheaper and cleaner by reducing peak demand by 5%, 10% over the next 5 years. It is an important conversation. We must have it. We must recognize economic opportunity, good jobs, jobs that young people are coming to Vermont to have, and how we are saving costs for Vermonters by moving this direction rapidly.
Today in the program, our guest is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. As we mentioned, Sue, right at the beginning of the program, very close race. It is possible that neither you or Phil Scott, the winner of the race, will get 50% of the vote, in which case it goes to the legislature for the first day of the session. Right now, can you tell us that you would pledge to support the candidate who gets the most votes?
Yes, I will. I believe that the person who gets the most votes should win.
That was very clear. That it's also the position of Phil Scott. He told us that yesterday. Let's go back to our callers and talk to Melanie in Rupert. Hi, Melanie. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I have a question for Sue Minter about school choice, and it's a little complicated. I've always voted a Democratic ticket, and I understand school choice is becoming more of a Republican issue. And I think a lot of communities are disgruntled about Act 46, but for Rupert and Paulett, Vermont, this really was an opportunity for us to increase educational opportunities for our kids, because some years ago, I think it might have been 1976, 16 VSA 827, a piece of legislation, allowed our towns to designate the use of New York high schools, which are really no further than the closest publicly funded independent school or another independent school from the center of our town. We can still use non-designated schools. However, our districts will only pay to the non-designated school the per-pupil tuition rate that's charged from the schools in New York. New York schools are heavily subsidized. We get $8,700 to use for either a Vermont public school in Dorset or Manchester, or a publicly funded school or an independent school. So that means if we want to use a Vermont school, we pay approximately 42% of the cost. This prevents our kids from having access to any of the provisions of Act 77, which I think are incredibly important: early college, dual enrollment, personalized learning plans. And right now, our town, I think, has suffered. 25% of the population is over 70. 11% is between the ages of 20 and 40. We have a non-binding referendum coming up on November 8th, where we're supposed to determine whether we will try to merge with school choice or designation.
Okay, Melanie, do we have a question here?
Yes, I would like to know if she can amend the law to allow us to have access to public school education in Vermont.
Okay.
So, Melanie, first of all, thank you for the engagement you are obviously having with this important conversation for your kids and your community and our future. And it reminds me of how I know that Vermonters around this state are really rolling up their sleeves together around what is so important for me as a mom of two kids who have gone through the public school, one who's through and one who's now a junior. Our schools are, I think, critically important to our future. Our kids are our future. And it is an incredibly difficult conversation that is happening around our state following Act 46. And I'm glad you're pointing out the other important acts around education reform that are so critical. What I can tell you is that I have already announced my plan to propose a year-long extension on the district unification models that are being required to present to the State Board of Education. And it is because I have really been digging in, and I have been to Rupert, a beautiful part of our state. But understanding how different our public schools systems are around the state. For my particular district, the Harwood Union District, which of course many of you may know is mourning a tragic, tragic loss of five kids. But we have come together as a district to vote to unify. For us, it's been a conversation that really has been sort of happening for the last couple of years. And while it was a difficult conversation, it was voted by over 80% to unify. My husband's on the school board. We have seven different school boards, seven different budgets, all for 1,800 students. For us, that unification, I believe, will help be more cost effective, reduce costs, and increase, I think, opportunities for education. However, when I've visited places like Rupert, like Bennington, like in Windsor County, Heartland, and also, by the way, visiting our public-private schools, Burr and Burton, St. Johnsbury Academy, really getting an understanding of how critically important those great schools are as part of our diverse system. And I do support school choice. I understand it more than I ever did before. And frankly, I believe Act 46 is kind of through phase one, where the more densely populated parts of our state have moved forward around unification. But I believe we are at a very different phase moving forward. And as governor, I'll be appointing four new members of the State Board of Education, which, as you know, is really the decision-making body, including a new chair. So I want to give more time because I know that these are brutally hard conversations and require the legislature to consider the unique characteristics of our rural parts of our state. So, Melanie, thank you for your passion, for asking these questions. I can't speak specifically, I'm sorry, to your particular district, but I know you need more time, you need more flexibility, and that's what I'm prepared to offer.
Well, let me ask you this about school choice. Under Act 46, if you're in a small district that currently has school choice, you don't have a high school in your district, and you merge with a larger district that has a high school, this new combined district has to choose to have a high school or school choice. And people who support school choice are worried that they're going to lose this if they merge with a district that has a high school. Would you change that part of Act 46?
And I have to say that what I have learned when discussing with the Board of Ed is that this Act 46 was not going to change school choice. So I will tell you, I don't want to undermine school choice. I don't know the specific regions where that becomes actually a decision point. And I'm sorry, I just don't know those details. But I will certainly move forward again with greater flexibility and time so that people can digest how these will have an influence in the future.
We got this email from John, who wants to know. You mentioned you were transportation secretary for some time. A couple of weeks ago, you were pretty critical of Phil Scott and his connection and perhaps a conflict of interest with DuBois Construction. And what John wants to know, when you were Secretary of Transportation, did you ever sign off on any bid contracts that Phil Scott's company bid to the state?
Yes, I did. And let me just talk a little bit about it and why it concerns me. You know, I really am concerned about the degree to which really people have lost faith in government and how important it is to have a government that functions well. I think that is accountable and transparent. And that people can trust. And, you know, it's why I have, since the very beginning of this campaign, pushed for an ethics commission and for new ethics laws. So there will be clear rules of procedure about ethics, conflicts of interest, and financial disclosure. I think Vermont needs to join 42 other states with such conflicts. And I do think that, you know, Phil has been a public servant for 16 years and has been running for governor for over a year. And I see that he has just agreed that if he is elected, he will sell his company to his cousin, his company, which has received over $4 million in state public taxpayer dollars, state contracts. Now, you know, I'm glad he's going to sell his company to his cousin, and I guess Trump is going to sell his company to Ivanka. But does that actually reduce the conflict of interest? The question was, have I signed contracts? And the answer is, I did sign a contract, but not without going to when I was presented with a contract to sign with the sitting lieutenant governor of the state to his own company. I went down to the Assistant Attorney General's office of the Transportation Agency and essentially threw the contract on his desk and said, how can I possibly sign that contract? How is this not a conflict of interest? How do we actually make sure that the public interest is the only interest in elected officials? And he explained that not only were there no rules around this, but because of that, I would in fact be putting the Agency of Transportation at risk if I did not sign for capricious action. So I did sign those contracts, and it is exactly why I have been pushing forward for clear rules of conduct going forward.
Today in the program, our guest is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sue Minter. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Richard, who is calling from South Newfane. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I've been to the wind farm in Rimouski, and I love it. I think it's beautiful. However, they didn't do mountaintop removal there. And if you've seen the pictures of what they did in Lowell, it's a four-lane highway across these ridgetops. As you worked in Department of Transportation, you're aware of the kind of flooding you get when you get all of the trees removed from a fragile place like this. And additionally, these are major migration routes for passing birds and hawks, and they're also habitats for nesting birds that are in decline. And I would like you to give me a little reassurance that Industrial Wind, who wants to build 200 miles of these ridgeline windmills, I want some reassurance that this process will go very slowly, because I'm tempted to vote for somebody else otherwise. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. And I think this is, again, getting Richard to the question of renewable energy and wind siting. As I mentioned previously, I am gravely concerned that we are coming to a place where large developers and towns are having a discordant conversation, and there really isn't an opportunity for proactive engagement. So I want to not only make sure that communities are planning where they will and won't site, but also, and by the way, looking at fragile ecosystems and wildlife habitat is obviously part of a planning process. I haven't seen all of the data about whether that's negatively impacted, so I'd want to actually see data around that. But I also want to say a little bit about the Public Service Board process, which the reason we have Section 248 is because we are dealing with electric generating facilities that have a actually not just state but regional impact on our power supply in our New England grid, and that it is actually important that we have an appointed professional board and a very judicial process, quasi-judicial process, to evaluate what the statute requires about reliability and resilience to the system and the larger picture, which is why, although I want to engage communities in the conversation, I do not support veto power. When you think about it, it is very difficult to cite facilities that have a larger scale impact. But what I know is Vermonters are so frustrated by the Public Service Board process, understandably, because they're used to a development review process. They're used to being able to give voice. And with especially solar, we have many, many projects under review right now by the board. I want to actually look at transforming the board process. Obviously, we cannot change rules or statute, but we can change the process to engage citizens earlier on. We could have public hearing officers being more involved in communities rather than just working in Montpelier. We can try to make sure some of the community conflict and discussion happens in advance of that very judicial legalistic review at the board. So I think there's a lot that we can do moving forward so that, A, the conversation is happening differently, B, communities are not feeling so frustrated and set out by the process that they feel is set up to not give them access, and to make sure we're looking long term. Of course, we have to look at all of those issues. Thank you.
So we have an interesting situation down in southeastern Vermont where a company that wants to build 24 turbines is offering voters in Windham roughly $700 each in each of the next 25 years if they'll support their project down there. What do you think of that approach?
Well, I find it uncomfortable. I know it has been upheld. I think what is important to me about the company's approach is what they have said is that they will abide by town's vote on whether the project should proceed. I know that's what happened in Lowell. I think that is important. I know it's not a criteria. It's a decision by that company, and I'm going to hold that company to that decision.
But the idea of offering folks $700 each, is that a little distasteful?
Look, I find these payments questionable, but I also look to what the Attorney General's determination has been, that it is legal.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Melissa in Morrisville. Hey, Melissa, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for taking my call. So it looks like paid family leave is going to be an issue pushed in the upcoming legislative session, and I'm wondering if Sue can please talk about her position and why she thinks paid family leave is something that will help Vermont families.
Thank you for raising this important question, Melissa. And you're right. I want us to move forward on paid family leave. And for me, it actually comes from my life experience. And I think every leader brings their life experience to their job. For me as a mom, my first pregnancy, I guess 25 years ago now, I was in a job where there was no guarantee of leave or whether I'd have my job back if I did take a leave. And boy, that was a difficult pregnancy. I was afraid to admit I was pregnant. And with all else that was going on, the fear of possibly losing or having to leave my job was the last thing I needed. And I was lucky enough to be able to argue for leave. And the business I was working for accommodated my needs. Now, the next baby I had, that was 17 years ago, I was part of the state workforce. I was a union member. I had a guaranteed leave. I knew that I could take leave. I wasn't afraid to talk about being pregnant. And it was accommodated, accepted, and nurtured. And I really understand what that means to families. I don't think it should simply be a matter of luck whether or not you have those access to leave. And it isn't just for new parents, moms and dads. It's also for people with aging family members or ill family members. My brother died of cancer also when I was a member of the State Employees Union, and I had the ability not only to have time, leave time, but people actually gave me extra time through our sick bank. And so I personally have experienced the value of that kind of leave. And I want us to work collectively with businesses. This is viewed as an opportunity to have an insurance pool where people, employees, would pay in, hopefully through their paychecks, and then be able to access leave payments. It is not meant to burden businesses. It is actually something that there is a commission report coming out on. I'm very excited to take on this concept, to be a state that is accommodating to young families and to people who are caring for their ill family members. Why? Because we want more people to live here. We want more young people. We want more families. I worked very hard as the Secretary of Transportation to accommodate more young workers. One of the things we did was create lactation facilities for new moms. This is the kind of workplace that young people are looking for and that I want us to have a state that accommodates, because that's what the next generation is looking for, and we can do it here.
I want to make sure I understand how it works. Would there be something like a payroll tax that would raise money to go into the overall fund?
I would hesitate to call it a payroll tax. It is a deduction off of your pay, and it is that's what we're exploring, what could be done. And the pool would be managed by the state. So there's a long way to go to understand how that's administered, how employees would pay into it. And, you know, of course, when working with businesses, I was meeting with a group of businesses in Virgin's just last week and talking about this as a really important policy objective, that these small businesses, which were part of a Main Street Alliance of business, of small businesses, that they want to make their workplace accommodate the workers. And that's what's great about Vermont. It is a place, a state, where we really look after one another. And I have to tell you, Bob, of course, you and I spoke a lot during Irene of what an extraordinary state we live in and how much we are all in it together. These last 10 days in Waterbury and throughout the Mad River Valley, seeing how families and a community is coming together around a tragedy, an unthinkable tragedy, inspires me, empowers me to want to continue to be a leader, thinking differently, innovatively, and bringing people together and getting things done. That's what I want to do as the next governor.
So under this plan, would you expect employers to make a contribution to the fund as well?
No, that isn't what we're looking at. We're actually looking at it being employee-funded.
And we've got just a little bit of time left. What about raising the minimum wage? What's realistic? How quickly can it go up, and where would you like to see it go to?
So, you know, we've talked about this. Too many Vermonters are struggling two and three jobs to make ends meet. They can't afford childcare. They can't afford college. And Vermonters need a raise. And we are moving in that direction. States around us are moving in that direction. My goal is to get to 1250 by 2018 and then build gradually up to $15. Hopefully that's where other states in our region are going to go too. The fight for 15 continues. I will be looking and working with businesses and listening as we go forward. But we need to continue to go forward because the struggle is not helping anyone, and it is real. I've been meeting so many Vermonters working two and three jobs. I met a family in Bennington. The husband had two jobs. The wife couldn't have a job. They had one car. She had to drive the husband between the two jobs because she needed to care for their disabled child. This is a harsh reality for so many families, and this is the way we build for the future.
Sue Minter is the Democratic candidate for governor. Sue, many thanks for being on the program today.
Great to be here, Bob, and thanks so much to the listeners.
Coming up Monday, we're going to give you a brief break from politics and elections with our Fall Migration Bird Show. Send your questions and sightings to us at Vermont Edition at vpr.net and then join us Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.